I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters,
and eventually the end of the world. Are you serious? I'm Ari Serious, and I'm planning to leave behind a big carbon footprint so that other generations may follow where I lead. But the Zodiac Killer only left behind a partial fingerprint, and therein lies today's tale. David Van Nuys, co-author of the book This is the Zodiac, speaking into the mind of a serial killer, will be with us in a little bit. But first, we have Jeff Deal. Steve Robles is looking vaguely sober over there.
Oh, man, it's pathetic, really.
That would be sad. And Diana Brown, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and frankly, a little concerned that you're sober, Steve.
Not as concerned as I am.
Well, hopefully one of your many associates will come through and remedy that situation.
Well, I did smoke a bunch of hash before the show, but evidently that wasn't enough.
That doesn't have any effect these days.
Come on.
It's a placebo for Steve, pretty much. It's just something to hold on to until the real stuff comes in. Because you just don't know. And isn't that what we're going to talk about right now? What we don't know that we don't even know that we don't know. Jeff Deal, our man at the twisting the knobs, as you like to say, directed our attention earlier this week to an item on Boing Boing, and it's all about the wiki. Once again, Larry Sanger, one of the co-founders of Wikipedia, has written a new, I'm not going to say manifesto, but he has a whole new bag out there, and he has recently launched basically a competitor to Wikipedia. And it has a very clever name here. It is called Citizendium.
And say that again?
Citizendium.
That's clever.
Isn't it? Well, hey, you know, there are a lot of words I can pluck out of the chose clever.
Spills right off the tongue.
I was going to say, by clever, does that mean you can't pronounce it?
I think it does. Again, if you don't know.
That would be intellectual, I think, clever. There's a very fine line between clever
and stupid.
Sexist or stupid, whatever.
Well, if we're going to quote our dear
smell
friends at Spinal Tap, we would say between clever and stupid. But that has spawned a lot of our own sayings over the years. Larry Sanger's main point is that he wants to improve Wikipedia. The model for Citizendium, the name that rolls right off the tongue, is that it'll have a little bit of a gentle expert oversight. Now, I've talked to a few people about that, and one person asked me, is that anything like slightly reduced civil liberties, or is it indeed just what we need for Web 2.0? So what do you think? I mean, he wants to see kind of a guiding body that keeps the information clearer and have users use their real names.
So I don't really see a controversy in the sense that, I mean, Wikipedia can do what it does, and Sanger can do what he does, and other people can ring the doorbell in the middle of our conversation. And,
which proves we're here.
You know, you just have multiple realities. Let them all compete. But he originally was doing this with the man that we interviewed.
Yes.
What's his name?
The other co-founder of Wiki.
Not the co-founder of Wiki.
Jimmy Wales, but the contactee,
the alien contactee.
Yeah, that dude. I remember
that dude. Yeah.
Studs Terkel.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's it.
Studs. Yeah.
Because we're all
doing
working.
Studs Terkel. Yeah. This would be a typically accurate entry into our Wikipedia, maybe.
At this moment, I feel the need to call out to all of our listeners for an intervention, please. Steve remains sober, and the clock is still ticking on the rest of this episode.
Why doesn't he just make Wikipedia better?
Well, no. Wikipedia operates according to its own, you know, relatively strictly open source rules, and that he wants to impose a group of experts on the discussion, if I understand. I mean, a lot of the better discussions in Wikipedia seem to have self-imposed groups of experts.
Right.
I mean, also, like, science
this
and
seems
technology
like a,
stuff seems to be pretty well
superimposed or something. Like the last project that the other guy was talking about was all just experts.
Yeah, I think
right.
he's going to have
this has some kind of combination, right?
Right, yeah, I think this is more of a combination. But I mean, So I mean, is he thinking he's going to like eliminate the?
If you're going to have that, then you're never going to have.
Actually, I think just as interesting is like there's always this ongoing personality conflict apparently between Sanger and Jimmy Wales, right? And there's been this argument about whether Sanger was really the co-founder of Wikipedia, and Wales going in and editing his own biography, right. So it didn't reflect that Sanger made a big contribution. Did he or didn't he make a big contribution?
Apparently, we don't know. We will never know.
Now, I have an experience. You know, I often think of this when people talk about the size of their contribution. I always remember like
the size of your contribution.
Take a look at the size of my contribution, baby.
People are looking at the the house next door, are you? I guess one of the questions it brings up is, you know, the rejection of the expert, and that, you know, like we have
expert choking smoker.
Well, like, you know, do you want to hear from the guy that lives down the street about a restaurant, or do you want to hear, you know, the Chronicle restaurant critic tell you about it?
I want to hear from the guy down the street who runs a restaurant about stem cells.
Excellent.
I mean, that's sort of, you know.
It's even broader than that, though, because if you're going to bring in experts on everything, immediately you're cutting down on, like, I mean, one of the things that's great about Wikipedia is, like, the really, like,
nature.
Well, in as much as it manifests itself into random entries, like, little topics, like, not everybody's going to be an expert on porn star Anita Blonde, who was born in Hungary. Right, into this country. Like,
very few people hold a master's degree in following female.
And you're talking to one of them. So, like, and I don't even own a fucking account on Wikipedia, so I'm not going to post about it. So, immediately, there's only one guy left. And so you'll never know about her unless, like, you know, I or the other guy say something. And there's
are they going to expert
douchebag from some lauded, you know, magna cum whatever.
Well, it seems Sanger wants to see a nice balance of both. He wants an expert at the head of the table, which reminds me of, you know, the traditional father sitting there carving the turkey. And then he says, unlike the old order, the opportunity to give the general public a place at the table
as well.
So we don't have to sit at the little kid's table.
That's right.
Know,
we actually
basically.
All right, well, that language. If he actually used that language, then I'm voting for Jimmy Wales now.
When the beam of light is broken by a solid object, such as this head, the electric eye control opens the faucet, and there's your drink.
David Van Nuys is a co-author of This is a Zodiac Speaking, Into the Mind of a Serial Killer, written with Michael D. Kelleher. Van Nuys provided the psychological profiling of the mysterious Zodiac in the book. Van Nuys is a retired professor at the psychology department at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California, and he's the host of the psychology podcast Shrink Wrap Radio. I spoke to him about Timothy Leary on one episode, and he's written for the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology, East-West Journal, and published research papers for Apple, Electronics Art, and Xerox, among so many others. He's also worked with Esalen Institute, Synanon, and neurolinguistic programming. Like the Beach Boys, he gets around.
I do my best.
I think Rakim also got around. Welcome, David.
Thank you so much. As I was saying, this is one of my favorite shows, so it'll probably be one of the first things I listen to.
We just say that over and over again.
Let's introduce that as a drinking game for this show. Every time he talks about how much he enjoys it.
Well, it's really true. You're just above This American Life.
Really?
So
we're
you
above
ought to feel really good.
Above This American Life.
And every word I say is the goddamn
truth. My head is getting bigger.
Is the goddamn truth. I never exaggerate.
Well, isn't it?
It is. So anyway, let's start with the Zodiac.
Okay.
And the legendary serial killer has returned to public attention recently with the film Zodiac by David Fincher, who I think is a fine filmmaker. And did you see the film? And
oh, yes. I saw the film. I saw it the first day that it came out. And I have to say they did a really good job for the most part. They were very accurate. For the things that they did cover, they left out some things that we could talk about.
2.5 hours long film.
It's a long story, and I was impressed by the fact that they were able to compress an awful lot of information into the film. And one thing I'd say to listeners is don't avoid seeing it because you think it's going to be too violent and too bloody. They really managed to tone that part down quite a bit.
It's odd from the guy who did Seven that he made this quite a bit more. It's like it's more psychological,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, yeah.
Less of hack and slash more.
Yeah, yeah, it could have been very ghoulish, but they didn't focus on that part.
And it's really hard to do a story with a narrative that has no conclusion. That's pretty brave.
Yeah, yeah. I keep hoping that the Zodiac will be found and caught so that then I will be either able to confirm or
write another book
or deny the conclusions that I came to in my book.
Well, how did you come to be called upon by Michael Kelleher to profile the Zodiac?
Oh, yeah, that's a good story. At the time, I was a mild-mannered professor and chair of the psychology department at Sonoma State University, and I get an email from this guy that I've never heard of, who was Michael Kelleher, and basically it says, hey, would you be interested in giving me your take on some letters from a serial killer? Mm-hmm. So I'm usually up for whatever, and so I said,
up
well,
for some fun.
I said, I don't have any experience in that domain, but you know, send me a few, and I'll noodle around with them and see what I think. So I noodled, and I emailed that off to him, and he got back to me with a very excited email, somehow able to convey great excitement in the email, right, saying, you know, I can hardly sit down to type this. I really like what you've done with this, and I'd like to reorganize the book that I was writing around your letters, if you'd be willing to do that. Now, at this point, I didn't even know it was about the Zodiac.
Oh, okay.
He said, you'll probably recognize this case of a serial killer at some point. And basically, I said, well, I don't follow that sort of thing. I doubt that I will. But at one point in the course, in the Zodiac's letters, he starts signing himself, this is the Zodiac.
Right. And at that point, a bell went off.
Yeah, a bell went off. Although
maybe it's the Zodiac.
Well, I had heard of the Zodiac case, right, but I hadn't really followed it.
Where were you in the 1960s?
Well, I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan in the 60s.
Fair John Sinclair.
The first killing happened. Actually, I believe I was at the University of Michigan with the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, I'm sure, was there at the same time. And I had a friend. I was a graduate student, but I had a friend who was a math professor. So I figure I'm only, two degrees of separation?
Degrees of separation from,
from the Unabomber,
who was actually at one point a suspect. Vaguely in the Zodiac case.
Oh, there's a fellow who's written a whole book about that. I think he's writing
Highly unlikely, but...
I thought so too, but I just met that guy, and he's writing a second book, and he's worked on that hypothesis for about 10 years, and he's collected his evidence.
He still thinks that it's possible?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe Lyndon Johnson, after he got through killing Kennedy, came to San Francisco.
A little bit of free time.
He was retired.
One of the fascinating things about this case is how many plausible, circumstantial evidence cases can be made against a wide variety of suspects. I mean, I'm contacted by people who say, look, I've got this waterproof case here.
Right.
And they run all their evidence by, and you go,
What's really weird about the case, I mean, I sort of have the vague ideas about what the Zodiac was. I didn't live out here in the late 60s. I thought of him as like this real mastermind kind of chess player, the Riddler genius.
No, I don't think so.
Killer, and he fucked up consistently.
Yeah, he did.
He was seen several times. There are drawings of him. Why couldn't they catch him?
Why couldn't they catch
like
him?
That's
a good question. Probably the reason they couldn't catch him is he stopped.
Yeah.
He either prudently or for some other reason.
But that picture getting around wasn't enough for people to go look. And I mean, he sort of looks like everybody else.
He
looked very much like everybody else looked at that period in time. Yeah. He had a crew cut and he wore glasses kind of like yours. Get back to your question. I came to Northern California January of 71. So I think maybe the
he had
last
just stopped.
Yeah, I think he
stopped
had
in
stopped
69,
then.
But he kept on claiming. In fact, this is sort of my next question. I mean, he apparently he killed five people, according to this book, or that they believe that he killed five people, but he claimed lots more.
Yeah, as many as 37 in one place.
So, I mean, as the serial killers go, he was a bit of a wimp.
By modern standards, he certainly has
been
eclipsed.
Well, by 70s standards,
even just
the big
recently.
Serial killers in the 70s, really, with John Wayne Gacy. I mean, there's some people just really totaled up vast numbers.
And yet his
overachievers, you're saying?
There.
And yet this case has generated more sort of enduring interest because, look, it's 40 years later.
Right.
They make a movie. There are a couple of online bulletin boards that get huge numbers of hits. You wouldn't believe it. One of them's based in, I think, Amsterdam. Weren't you there recently?
Yeah, but I didn't see anything about
the Zodiac there. There's another connection. Glasses, Amsterdam.
There. Yeah, see? There you go.
I'm building a case
cold
right
water
now.
Down my back.
Yeah, used to sneak off when I was 14 to San Francisco. Yeah. Yes, indeed. And,
so it's up there with the Jack the Ripper case. That's what I want to say.
It's got the cryptography aspect to it. It's got the mystery aspect to it. He tried to be the Riddler. He wasn't really quite as clever as the Riddler. But talk about it. What does his use of... tell me about the fact that he did use cryptography, and what did the use of cryptography say about him, and how might that have led us to the right person?
Well, I think it says a couple of things about him. For one thing, it says a lot of things. It fits into his taunting personality, for one thing, kind of catch me if you can.
Right.
I'm going to give you some clues.
Right.
It also suggests to us that he had a certain technical orientation and technical facility just to know anything about how you would go about generating that sort of thing.
Right.
Also, if you look at the actual cryptograms that he made, they're very neat, lined up in perfect rows and columns, which would suggest that he was a detail-oriented, fastidious sort of guy.
Right.
Those are some of the things that come to mind immediately.
So, I mean, he was clearly hungry for attention.
Anything else, that's what really pops out.
You think this generally characterizes serial killers? I mean, some of them, I mean, their crimes get attention, but they don't quite play the game with the press.
Yeah, I think he's fairly unique. I don't know. You know, actually, I've not been a student of serial killers. I was sort of dragged into this, not kicking and screaming, willingly dragged in. But I deliberately refrained from reading books about serial killers because I wanted to bring my own
fresh
perspective.
Sure.
And I really didn't want my life to revolve around serial killers. So after the book was out, I didn't go and read up on it then either. So in some ways, I'm a bit naive about this. But I'm not aware of other cases that scream out so loudly about manipulating the press, manipulating the public. And in some ways, I see him as the prototypic terrorist because of he terrorized the whole Bay Area through his use of the media. And of course, other terrorist groups or freedom fighters have figured out how to do that sort of thing.
And he didn't have a political motivation. And one thing I get from reading the book is that this may have been the press may have been the only person he was communicating with.
Yeah,
like this was his relationship.
Right.
Oh, that's
this is his only relationship in life.
Good point, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's so.
Yeah. Now we also see the notion of the outsider comes up in this book.
Right.
Somebody who's an extreme outsider, doesn't fit in. Of course, we see the same thing last week in events at Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
And now so many of us have these feelings of at one time or another of being, you know, complete outsider, of being a misfit, of despising, you know, the people in my college.
I've been there. I was able, in a way, you know, to understand Cho.
Right.
I mean, it's not so foreign from my experience to remembering back when I was in college and I felt alienated.
Right.
And I had violent fantasies, I didn't act out on
it. From a psychological perspective, what's that line between fantasizing about vengeance, which probably everybody does, maybe certain pacifists or something.
Well, of course, the really important line is whether or not you act out on it.
Right, but what's the line that allow somebody
the line that's sort of just short of that, I think, is if a person finds that they're thinking about it all the time, fantasizing about it a whole lot, then that's a good warning sign. And certainly the teachers of Cho and other people, his roommates and so on, they saw a long time ahead of time that this was a sick puppy. But nobody knew what to do about it. And even a judge had ordered that he receive therapy, but I don't think he followed up. He didn't go take that.
Do you think there's a difference? I mean, like in the 70s, there were mostly like serial killers who like killed one or two people at a time over a long span of time. And now we have sort of the event, you know, where somebody...
I think there is a big difference. I think that the serial killer and this and the what we call this the mass murderer, perhaps, that they do have somewhat different psychologies. The serial killer, it's often thrill based, and there's a very strong and clear sexual component often, and it's an escalating thing where they evolve and. They have to do it more and more frequently.
Like a resistance to a drug, to having to take more and more.
Exactly. Okay. And there may be symbolic elements. You know, sometimes they dress up the corpse or lay them in a certain position and so on. That's expressing messages or inner messages or whatever, symbolic stuff relating to their pathology. Whereas with the mass murderer type thing that we see, it's basically, I think, more suicidal. Somebody has sat on a lot of rage for a long time, very much an outsider, and keep it bottled up, and then boom, it kind of explodes.
But they do plan it generally, and many of these things are planned for a period of time. And one thing that Cho has in common with Zodiac is he wanted to get into the media.
Yeah.
Right.
But after.
But after he was gone.
What kind of gratification is
there
in that?
Multimedia package. He isn't around to see it, but, you know, I guess he at least knew
he would have a place
at the table.
I'm just glad he didn't do it as a podcast.
Oh, yeah, that's true. One of the interesting things about...
Especially live streaming.
One of the interesting things about the Zodiac is he was obsessed with a Gilbert and Sullivan play called The Mikado. If he had been obsessed with Black Sabbath, there would have been congressional hearings.
Yeah, I think this
but,
guy...
Yeah, well, tell us about that.
Well, if he had not been...
That's outrageous.
Mentioning the Black Sabbath thing, I think if he had not turned out to be the killer, I mean, I think he would have been the prototype... hacker, geeky,
he was a nerd. He had a nerd thing. Yeah.
Yeah. If only there had been video games, with a shoot 'em up. Who knows? Maybe that would have satisfied.
He could have been a griefer on the.
Yeah. There you go.
Interesting question. So, I mean, do you think that there is a video games might have a larger sort of social palliative thing where it actually. Yeah, a release that prevents a lot of serial killers.
Boy, I don't know. You know, it is a great question, and you could argue that, argue the other side that it's rehearsal for action. Right. You know, certainly the military has grabbed onto this technology for training purposes. You know, virtual reality and so on. So
Cho seems like somebody who might have been headed for the military. Although all that camaraderie might have been a little difficult.
You know, one thing I haven't heard commented on about Cho that struck me was the way he was sort of get up for the camera, sort of a Rambo kind of thing.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah, the pose.
So it suggested to me that there was a very strong fantasy element, that he had, you know, really strong fantasies about being this kind of macho guy. And
he wanted to look cool on camera too. Yeah. Clearly,
video in the van at the shooting range.
Right. I mean, maybe if he, got into punk rock.
Back to the Mikado. I never commented on Mikado.
Yeah.
Just quickly, do you think that then maybe
Diana? Can you sing a few lines from Mikado?
If only I could.
Yeah. Well, do tell us.
But my quick question was, do you think maybe video games kind of desensitize us to violence and then...
I think that's a distinct possibility, yes. I think there's a lot in our culture that's desensitizing us to violence and that it's not good.
Pew, pew!
All right.
I can't sing something from...
Do talk about the... Yeah. Do talk about Mikado.
Particularly with the push-button kind of warfare scenarios that we're entering into today, where you don't have to see the blood and the guts and all you have to do is press a button.
The simulacrum of killing. Anyway, let's...
Getting back to the Mikado. There is this character in the Mikado who's Coco, the Lord High Executioner.
Right.
And he quotes from there, from the Mikado, and he also... in some, I think, clever ways, distorts some of the poetry from the Mikado and kind of bends it to his own use. I could read some of that if you're interested in hearing about it.
Yeah, let's hear that. Yeah,
and the getup that he has at the Lake Berryessa killing, where he comes over this rise. There's this young couple, presumably there to make out, although nobody ever says that. But it's kind of a subtext, what are they doing at Lake Berryessa?
Right.
And he kind of comes over the hill, this stranger in the strangest getup, outlandish getup of a kind of box-like mask with sort of a front piece that hangs over his chest, and it's got the zodiac symbol on it, and he's got a knife and a scabbard and a gun and a coil of clothesline, plastic clothesline. Mm-hmm. Well, that mask somehow was very suggestive also of Coco, the Lord High Executioner from the Mikado. Mm. So, of course, I speculate in the book, well, where did he get his exposure to Gilbert and Sullivan?
Thank you.
Seems unlikely,
doesn't
it?
That's the question.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of little clues, and I had to go way out on many limbs using very fragmentary evidence, because the only evidence we had were these 22 notes that he wrote either to the police or to the press to taunt them. But there seemed to be little clues that perhaps he was from the UK or from the South. Some of the phrases and turns of speech, and let's say that he either came from the UK or from a family that had recently immigrated from the UK, that could account, say, for the exposure to Gilbert and Sullivan. On the other hand, he seemed like this really sort of technically adept guy, so it'd be easy to imagine that he was the guy in charge of working the console at Gilbert and Sullivan, which was running in San Francisco at that time.
I was going to ask.
Mikado was running. Yes, and you said you had something to read.
Yeah, let's see if I can find one of
these. Do you know which company?
Actually, why don't we?
No, my knowledge doesn't run quite that deep.
Why don't we break for a moment to hear a tune, and then we will come back with a reading from Mikado, the play that's influenced the Zodiac.
To a height a few can scale, safe along in weary dances, surely never had a male under such like circumstances, so adventurous a tale, which may rank with most romances. Taken from the county jail, by a set of curious chances, surely never had a male so adventurous a tale.
Give up!
We're back with David Van Nuys, and we were talking about the Zodiac and his fascination with a Gilbert and Sullivan play, The Mikado, and David is going to read something that he wrote about this, and this is the Zodiac speaking.
Oh, well, this is not what I wrote,
not
but this
wrote.
Is directly
from him, okay.
From the Zodiac, and it's partial text from a letter to the San Francisco Chronicle on July 26, 1970, And it takes a portion from the Mikado, but it kind of twists it to his ends. And he writes, "This is the Zodiac speaking. I shall," and notice that I shall rather than I will. You know, most people would say I will, right? It's a little interesting. He says,
formal.
I shall, on top of everything else, torture all 13 of my slaves that I have waiting for me in paradise. Some I shall, now this is the part that begins to sound like the Mikado. Some I shall tie over anthills and watch them scream and twitch and squirm. Others shall have pine splinters driven under their nails and then burned. Others shall be placed in cages and fed salt, beef, until they are gorged. Then I shall listen to their pleas for water and I shall laugh at them. Others will hang by their thumbs and burn in the sun, and I will rub them down deep heat to warm them up. Others I shall skin them alive and let them run around screaming. And all billiard players I shall have them play in a darkened dungeon, all with crooked cues and twisted shoes. Yes, I shall have great fun inflicting the most delicious of pain to my slaves."
And that fascinated me because I read that first before I knew it was from Mikado. I was like, what did he have against billiard players? But he got that directly from the Gilbert and Sullivan play.
Yes, and I was just looking in the book to see if I could find the original from Gilbert and Sullivan.
They used the cadence but changed the words.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Changed some of the words. In that case, he changed a lot of the words. There are other ones where he came very close. There was one where he came very close to using the exact phraseology.
Yeah. I don't think I can find it right away.
Right.
It might be somewhere in this area
right
here, where my thumb is somewhere around there.
So, I mean, in terms of how he used language, "I shall," he wanted to do a God kind of thing. And you were also struck by the fact that he called himself a murderer rather than...
It was the Lamplighters. They're the Gilbert and Sullivan producing organization in the Bay Area.
Oh.
I just saw it here. Oh, my.
But he didn't seem like he was a terribly educated man, despite some of these references. And what about all the misspellings?
Yeah.
And nobody conjectures that the misspellings might have been the one thing he did to try to throw people off.
Actually, people do conjecture that.
He was very intellectual.
We don't know whether he was dyslexic or whether, in fact, this was a devious trick to throw people off. And it might have. Would you like to hear the original lines that he distorted from Gilbert and Sullivan? Here's how the original reads. "As some day it may happen that a victim must be found, I've got a little list of society offenders who might well be underground and who never would be missed, who would never be missed. There's the pestilential nuisances who write for autographs, all people who have flabby hands and irritating laughs, all children who are up in dates and floor you with them flat, all persons who, in shaking hands, shake hands with you like that. All third persons who on spoiling tete-tetes insist, they'll none of them be missed." And there's and then the chorus goes, "He's got them on the list, he's got them on the list, and they'll none of them be missed, they'll none of them be missed." And then he says, "There's the banjo serenader and others of his race, and the piano organist, I've got him on the list, and the people who eat peppermint and puff it in your face, they never would be missed, they never would be missed." Then the idiot praises with enthusiastic tone, all centuries but this in every country but his own. Well, it goes on and on.
But
you get the feel of it.
Right,
though.
But he actually didn't have a list. He was he chose people at random. And he chose pretty easy victim. He didn't go for
In terms of the people that he went as targets,
he found people in isolated areas and
couples. Three of the attacks were against young couples in lovers' lanes, which suggests that here's a guy who's sexually and socially frustrated.
Now, there is also a bit of a 60s aspect to some of his language, but he doesn't sound like a 60s person. He sounds like maybe somebody who's on the cusp of being part of that generation, but also part of another generation. But it is ironic that he refers to cops as pigs.
Yeah, he does. Maybe and blue meanies. And blue meanies, right. Too. Wasn't that in Yellow Submarine?
Yeah, yes, so I was going to say right, the Beatles right. are yeah. involved. What's that?
Yeah, so he must have gotten exposed to that. But in no other way does he come across as a counterculture type person.
Mm-hmm. Right, but there is one cryptogram where LSD seems to pop up a few times.
Oh, I missed that. I don't recall that. You know, it's been almost 4 years now, 5 years since I wrote the book, and it's like, or co-wrote the book. Right. And it's like out of pen, out of mind.
I know the feeling. Well, let's move on from the Zodiac.
Well, before we do, wouldn't you like to let people know sort of the outlandish conclusions that
to? Let's have some conclusions and let's
is there time to do that?
Let's please do that and
okay, well, talk about this is somewhat cautiously because I was going from very fragmentary evidence, but to kind of cut to the chase, you know, I felt I had to come to some conclusions. And the big question is, okay, why wasn't he caught? Where is he? Could he still be alive?
Right.
And he definitely could still be alive. And I actually concluded that he suffered from what we would call, what we used to call multiple personality. Mm-hmm. What today?
And that's very rare, isn't it?
It's very rare. When I was in graduate school, I was taught that I would probably never see one in my practice. Something seems to have happened in recent years that a lot of the therapists I know, at least in Sonoma County and the Bay Area, claim that they have a whole practice full of people who are multiples. So somehow this has become one of the diagnoses du jour.
Yes.
And whether or not there are actually more of them or it's just a different diagnostic perception, I don't know. But
they've lowered the bar on so many things.
The military, more multiples. All right.
I do know that while I was in private practice, it's a diagnosis that I never used.
Okay.
Somehow, though, in looking through this material, I saw a distinctive personality change unfolding over the course of the letters, plus some of the things that he said led me to speculate that, in fact, he suffered from multiple personality, or what today would be called dissociative identity disorder, and that he was gradually getting better, and he may have gotten even better. Perhaps he might have found a therapist who might have helped that process along. One of the things that we know about dissociative identity disorder is that as people get older, it tends to go away. Mm-hmm. So I'm hypothesizing that his killer personality kind of went underground, and another personality, which is basically kind of a cranky kind of, he would be an irritating person, would be my guess.
Oh, I know that guy.
He'd be right. I get a lot of letters from people saying they know this guy. So that's sort of where I came out. And he had elements of paranoid personality disorder and hysterical personality disorder and certainly psychopathic personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. If you go through the DSM, you'll see that there are elements of all of those.
So would he be out there living now not even knowing that he did this, or he came to grips with it and thought, well, yeah, but I'm not going to turn
make
my,
mistakes.
I'm not going to turn
it
myself in.
It was a phase.
You
know?
I feel bad, but I'm not going to go to jail.
You know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure. I think it could be either way.
Yeah.
I have a question. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
There's a question from the chat room, actually, from the web. They're asking what you think of Gray Smith.
Okay, Gray Smith locked in on a suspect. Allen is the guy's last name. I'm blocking on his first blah blah Allen, and that's the movie. Also focuses on Allen, and they present a very strong circumstantial case for it being Allen. My co-author, who researched this much longer than I did and knows all of the material in much greater depth than I do, my responsibility was just the psychological part. Mm-hmm. He doesn't believe it was Allen.
Wasn't there partial fingerprints?
No, there's no finger. There were partial fingerprints, yes, but they don't match Allen.
Right.
And so there's no nothing other than circumstantial evidence for Allen. Now, a number of other people have developed very strong circumstantial cases against other suspects. So we think that the movie was flawed in terms of presenting Gray Smith's viewpoint.
Focusing on Allen.
Arthur Lee Allen, creepy person. It was probably a creepy person, much like Allen, if it wasn't him. Right. And certainly he was very creepy, and there was a lot of circumstantial evidence to suggest him. But what the movie doesn't reveal is that there are quite a few other viable candidates.
Are there any candidates who leapt to the forefront in your mind did you take a look at the possibilities as you were?
I've been in touch with people write me. I get letters, I get emails, and I can't do anything. It's so frustrating because they and I'm willing to hear them out. And they say, I've tried contacting the FBI, I've contacted the police, nobody will listen to me, they treat me like I'm a nutcase. Mm-hmm. So I hear them out. And sometimes, they have pretty good, pretty good stories. Like I've recently been hearing from an older fellow, he's probably my age. I want to call him an old coot. He sounds like an old coot, but he's probably my age. And in Colorado, and he's sure it was one of his relatives who beat his wife and abused his kids and was abused as a kid and set fires and did all sorts of things and who lived in the right places during the Zodiac's reign of terror. And one of the places that he lived was Paradise, or right near Paradise, California. Uh-huh. So there are all of these references about slaves in Paradise. So here's an example of the kind of circumstantial things that people will bring to bear. Also, this guy finds his name in one of the cryptograms where the Zodiac says, if you can crack this, you'll know who I am. Well, there's an anagram in that last part that spells out humble, according to this guy who called me. And that's one of the family names. So I get these kinds of calls. There's a guy on the East Coast who's built up a very strong circumstantial case against a prominent San Franciscan who would not fit my profile.
Now that's interesting.
A wealthy, well-known,
we wouldn't dare to say who
prominent San Franciscan who I will not name.
It's not the mayor. He was too young.
Right. And it's very compelling. Well, there was a show on Primetime, the TV show Primetime, where they actually, I can't remember if they identified the suspect by name or not, but they looked at three suspects. Arthur Lee Allen was one. That's Gray Smith's suspect. The guy I was just talking about, the prominent San Franciscan, and maybe off mic, and a young guy who was convinced that his father was the Zodiac because of how he knew his father and some letters that the father that he had and handwriting samples.
Okay.
So they did, Primetime coughed up the money for some DNA testing. They figured, whoever licked the stamps was probably the Zodiac because at that time DNA testing didn't exist.
Wow, so they still had
he couldn't have known, to guard against that. The DNA testing ruled out all three.
Oh.
Hmm. However, there are people who are questioning the methodology that was used in the DNA testing, and they're clamoring for more testing. Hmm. I can't give you all the details of that.
Well, it would be fascinating if this story ever has a
I hope
conclusion.
It does. I want it as
it would
much
be,
as anybody.
Very interesting. Anyway, before we let you go, let's ask a few questions about some stuff that you do. You have a history with transpersonal humanist psychology, and which seems to have been replaced by drugs and neurology mostly at this point in the psychiatric profession. Basically, what's the right drug to prescribe?
Oh, okay. I was going to say, not by me.
Although, have you got any good,
then Steve will want to talk to you.
Has there been an evolution in these areas that you can speak about?
Yes, there's been, there's a whole new movement called positive psychology.
Right. Is that like hedonic also? Hedonistic psychology?
No, I don't think so.
Well, don't let me...
But positive psychology was, quotes, invented and championed by Martin Seligman, who is a very prominent psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was about 7 or 8 years ago president of the American Psychological Association. And he kind of announced to the world, I have discovered, I am inventing, I am announcing something called positive psychology. Well, all of us who've been working in humanistic psychology, you know, who bow to the altar of Abraham Maslow and Carl Rogers and Carl Jung and people like that, who basically people who said, you know, human nature is about more than pathology. And why don't we look at the psychology of health and not just the psychology of pathology? That's been around for at least the length of my career.
Right.
From certainly in the 60s, there was a great upwelling of that. So we were a little put out with Seligman for not acknowledging that. But I also understand his motivations. He comes from a strong research background, and he felt that humanistic psychology had failed because it hadn't sufficiently established itself in research. He also felt that it led to a narcissistic me generation, and he didn't want to fall into that pitfall. So I understand.
And there's a neurological component to this positivism, the idea that rather than reliving your traumas, which only kind of juice up those particular circuits, neural circuits, you know, go for the good stuff that's going to make you feel better.
Yeah. And he's certainly marshaling research that indicates that if you have positive attitudes, if you're an optimist, you're going to live longer, you're going to be healthier. And there's a whole lot of evidence to that effect. So so good for him. You know, I'm jumping on board his ship now.
He's interesting.
I'm a positive psychologist.
Yeah. I've contacted Seligman. Seligman, if you're out there, I asked you to be on the show.
Hey,
I tried to get him.
We'd really like to have you.
I tried to get him on my show.
Well, in fact, that's the place where we want to end. Do tell us about Shrink Wrap Radio and who's been on and who's coming up.
Are You Serious has been on Shrink Wrap Radio.
No, I deny it outright.
So if you are an Are You Serious fan, you definitely want to go to www.shrinkwrapradio.com, rap spelled R-A-P.
And he's all right. I'm not a huge fan.
So I retired from university teaching, and I said, okay, what am I going to do now? And then I heard about podcasting, and somehow that just clicked. And, well, what can I create a podcast about? Well, psychology is something I know about. And so actually, Shrink Wrap Radio has been a way for me to get the word out that there is a much broader realm of psychology than what most people have been exposed to. It's not all about pathology. It's not all about running rats. And so I interview people, Tibetan Rinpoches, people who are into psychedelics, people who are into organizational psychology, spiritual dimensions of psychology, psychotherapy, various kinds of personality typologies, hypnotherapists, Jungian. A lot of it's been around Jungian issues, understanding your dreams. And it's been very gratifying to me, as I'm sure you found podcasting to be. This was just a gleam in my eye. I didn't know if anybody was going to listen. I didn't know who it was going to appeal to. I thought if any real psychologist listened to it, maybe I would be drummed out of the academy or out of the neighborhood or something.
No longer have his place at the table.
Yeah, so I've been very gratified.
Probably safe in this neighborhood.
Mostly I hear from, I think the largest portion of my audience is a mature adults who have a lot of curiosity about a lot of different fields.
Right.
And then I have students who are psychology students who say, wow, how come I never hear any of this stuff in my school?
Right.
This is great. And then I also hear from professionals who say, right on, some of the stuff that I hear helps me in my practice. So it's all been very gratifying. Okay. And I have a second one now, a website called mentalhelp.net has hired me to do 2 interview type podcasts a month for them. That's called Wise Counsel.
Right.
And on the Shrink Wrap Radio, I've just put out episode number 86, so I've been doing it for over a year.
Congratulations.
And what a rush.
And your URL for Shrink Wrap Radio is
www.shrinkwrapradio.com.
All right, and we'll have a link to it on areyouseriousradio.com. And I want to thank David Van Nuys for joining us today. And next week we'll have, I don't know, but it will be
surprise.
Somebody wonderful, and they will be streamed.
Thank
and,
you.
Thanks to the web audience for coming and joining our inaugural web streaming event. And it'll happen every week now, every Sunday at 2 p.m. Pacific.
Love is the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?